Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, iPad 3. Will the heat kill my GPU? Windows 8 on virtual machines. Speed up Windows boot. GTX 680 triples the CUDA cores. AMD 7850 and 7870. Are these the perfect mid-price GPUs? Case mods, check out this site. And if you've got a tax refund to spend, we've got ideas. They're all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 160, recorded March 8, 2012. Will the heat kill my GPU?
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Ford, featuring Curve Control to help protect against crashes on curves. Look for Curve Control available in the 2013 Ford Taurus. And you can learn more at Ford.com/cars/Taurus. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, and this show is going to bring you the best and most exciting news in your computer hardware and a little bit of tablet news. And, of course, we'd love to answer your questions. We do that in the second half of the show. My partner in crime here, as always, Mr. Ryan Shrout, who, oddly enough, is like a mile from where I'm sitting right now. Ryan, man, what are you doing in town?
I hate that feeling. I hate that feeling that I fly, like, 2,100 miles across the country to come to San Francisco, and then I either A, can't meet up with you, or B, can't get up to the to Petaluma to go to the studio, because it's like that last, it's like, you know, the telephony problem of the last mile is always the problem. For me, it's the last 100 miles to get to Petaluma that is the problem.
You will not escape
it
me
today. It never seems to work out.
I know where your restaurant is, and two, this is my late night to work in the city, so as long as you get out of that restaurant before midnight, I'm going to track you down.
Fair enough. I'll turn on whatever that tracking service is. You can just follow me around wherever you want until you find me.
Careful what you ask for.
Don't do that, actually. No, let's not do that.
Let's spend a brief 30 seconds talking about, just to get it out of the way, since it's obviously one of the biggest news story this week, the new iPad. It's not the iPad 3. It's not the iPad HD. Mm-hmm. It is the iPad, which is, oddly enough, more expensive than the iPad 2. I expect that name is going to be changed just to stop confusing people in a few weeks. Quad-core graphics, A5X, which is essentially Apple's internally supercharged ARM processor, and the Retina display, which everyone I know who's touched it is essentially gushing and weeping over.
Really?
It's better than looking at paper. It's better than being naughty in the bathroom with yourself. It's better than anything I've ever seen in my life. It is the best-looking monitor in the history of the planet. That part, a couple of people have like, I get it, but it's still a 10-inch monitor. And, you know, I understand like the – so when we talk about monitor resolution, one of the big things that started coming – that people started thinking about was the KEL factor when HDTVs rolled in. And the KEL factor basically says – the higher the resolution, the more comfortable it is, or the better it looks closer to your face. So you're looking at like 264 DPI on the iPad, the new iPad, which means it should be look absolutely fantastic up to about 15 inches from your face. That's what they're saying is the optimal viewing distance, because the pixels are so tightly packed on the monitor, they don't start to break down individual pixels until you get ridiculously close. So normally, when we look at the KEL factor, it's why a 42-inch 1080p television looks great at 8 feet away from you or 6 feet
away.
So
with the ratio, essentially.
Yeah, essentially, it's kind of funny. Like, people are like, oh, I could buy a 42-inch HDTV and use it on my desktop, and then I'll have a 42-inch monitor. It sounds like a great idea until a 42-inch 1080p monitor is 3 feet from your face, and you're like, wow, those pixels are really big, and this desktop is really crowded because, you know, what looks good at 8 feet may not necessarily look good at 3 feet. So this what we're looking at right now is they kind of tweaked around with the location of the electronics inside the pixels to kind of cram the RGB elements as tightly together as possible. They're doing rendering of text, super, super, super tightly rendered text. And of course, everybody at Apple wants everybody in the world to go out and immediately develop a Retina level application, like to take advantage of the insane graphics here.
Yeah.
A lot of computing power.
I have to admit, I just want to see the screen. Like, I just,
yeah,
you and I just want to see it. I mean, you the 2048 by 1536 was the resolution of my first, I think, like a 24-inch or 22-inch CRT display from years and years ago when we were like, how can we test the highest resolution possible for graphics cards? And it was 2048 by 1536 on a CRT screen. And the fact that you can get that now on a 10-inch display that's, you know, that thin is really impressive still.
It's literally like a 30-inch monitor resolution crammed in one-third of the physical, or, you know, one-third of the diagonal measurement. That's a big deal in terms of resolution. You know, I can remember, like, looking at the first 1080p monitor and being like, not 1080p, looking at the first 1024 by 768 monitor and looking at photos on it and realizing what an incredible improvement this was over, you know, 640 by 480, 800 by 600 monitors. You know, VGA monitors are still pretty common. I'm really curious to see how this impacts, you know, media consumption. It's interesting and maybe a little bit telling that you know, they release the Retina, you know, display on the iPad at the same time when they barely mention that they've released a new Apple TV that supports 1080p.
Yeah.
Which is exciting for me because that's like, okay, so some of the Netflix content is 1080p. I certainly have a lot of content that I've ripped and stored on a server that's 1080p. And you know, my wife loves the Apple TV because it's really simple to operate. It just works. So I wonder if there's going to be a push in the iTunes store to deliver more 1080p content. And then also, I'm really curious. I mean, the Apple spent most of the time, more time talking about iPhoto than they did around the hardware.
Which is weird. But
it's weird. Yeah. You know, a lot of people were basically like, oh, Apple's lost its way. Oh, Tim Cook doesn't know what he's doing. But it's like, you know, you lose a major family member, you're maybe not thinking as straight for a couple months afterwards. So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, and we'll see how things go for the next couple product releases. It was a little strange. It's like, we don't have a real name for this unless they think.
I don't get it all, right? So you go into the Apple store and the iPad is now newer than the iPad 2. But what's going to be even more confusing is that if that trend continues, they're going to release the new iPad. And you're going to go into the store looking for the iPad or the cheaper iPad. Like, maybe we have the iPad that's $499 and we have the other iPad that's $399. It's like going in now and looking at MacBooks, only they get rid of the old ones before they bring out the new ones.
It almost sounded like
with the iPhones and iPads, they probably won't do that.
I don't know. It almost sounded like an inside joke. Like, everybody walks in and they go, I want the new iPad. So we'll just call it the new iPad. I don't know. It's certainly a big news. The other thing I thought was really interesting is, I will say this up front and loudly, anytime Apple mentions benchmarks, I raise my eyebrow and my big giant, like, whatever. Because I remember when Apple used to go out of their way to stage benchmarks to make the PowerPC look better. When I say stage benchmark, what I'm really saying is cheat.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to take a highly optimized version of this benchmark that's been custom tuned by our engineers and compare it to a standardized downloadable version of the benchmark that's not available, you know, not an optimized format on an Intel PC that we found on the side of the road. Let's see which one runs faster. And which is, you know, a slightly more dramatic, you know, basically something they did in the past. That said, they're claiming, I want to say, you know, twice the performance and four times the speed of the Tegra 3 in their device. Now, I do not benchmark tablets, and I don't think it really matters for all intents and purposes because, hey, you can't run OS 10 on any other tablet, and hey, there's no Android operating system that could run on the iOS iPad. Hardware. Yeah,
right.
On the iPad. So, you know, you could do sort of, you know, having done cross-platform benchmarks for, you know, Windows NT back in the day, it's enormously difficult to compare applications across different hardware and operating systems. But that said, it's an interesting statement. You know, they also have been throwing a lot of money behind their CPU development, so it might even be a true statement. But we will
we'll have to see. The only other interesting point I'll make on the hardware side is that you think they have doubled graphics performance, but quadrupled the number of pixels that they need to render to. So, you know, it depends on how much headroom the previous generation iPad had in terms of its own GPU horsepower, whether or not they maybe have overstepped their boundaries. But we'll just have to see once the games come out and those types of applications come out that actually can utilize that graphics horsepower as well.
Has Apple's reach exceeded its grasp?
Yeah.
It's going to be exciting to see. And I know the app, there's a map application I desperately want to run on this, partially to see what it looks like on that display, and partially because this particular application absolutely utterly Western Maps USA utterly desperately needs as much horsepower as you scenic map Western USA utterly needs as much horsepower.
I remember you talking about that before.
So that's I'm tempted to, you know, I want to find somebody with an iPad 3 so I can run this application on it so I can actually look at the performance. And then of course I need to go sell a kidney or my car.
So. It's only another $499 for the base model anyway.
Yeah, but 16 gigabytes is never enough, man.
No, it's not. Especially when you think 4 or 5 of that is the operating system, right? So,
Windows 8 consumer preview. How excited are you about it?
I'm not really that excited, and I don't know why.
I'm enjoying it the more I use it, I got to say.
Okay, that's good news. And that's what this little article we were going to mention real quick is somebody, one of the guys over at PC Per wrote up how to install, just a step-by-step basically how to install Windows 8 on a VirtualBox virtual machine so that you can get some experience with Windows 8. You can spend some time playing with it, but you're not relegated to using it as your primary operating system. You don't have to replace anything on your computer. You don't have to format. You don't have to install over. You know, when you use this free VirtualBox software, you have the capability to run this without, you know, screwing up your system. You just allocate some space. I think he recommends 15 gigs just to start out with, that kind of thing. And you can install Windows 8 on there and play around with it. It's a free consumer preview. It's a free virtual machine software. So you combine the two and you've got your own Windows 8 machine. Now, you can't really judge it. You won't be able to play. I wouldn't play games on it. The performance is not going to be the same, you know, those types of things. But that's kind of what I'm interested in at this point is working out. Is it even relevant right now to test gaming performance on this Windows 8 consumer preview? Are we going to see any differences, that kind of stuff? That's kind of what we're things we're looking at.
Considerably radically different in terms of the interface the developer preview was from the consumer preview. I would not be surprised to find some healthy, I won't say radical, but I wouldn't be surprised to see some healthy improvements. Slash, it's all basically sitting on top of Windows 7, so I wouldn't get too excited. I wouldn't expect, like, between now and release, you know, the gold release, I wouldn't expect any radical changes in performance. It's not like there's a new driver architecture, unless they suddenly decided at the last minute to change to a new driver architecture, but I really don't see them having any interest in that at this point.
So I don't think it's changing much between where it is now, where it's going to end up. The other thing that happened this week was actually the release of yet another graphics card. Patrick, I know you're super excited about this.
Can't be any better than the water-cooled behemoth we saw last week.
Well, this one might actually be more up your alley. I think it's going to be up more of our readers and listeners and viewers' alleys because this is the 7800 series. This is the Radeon HD 7870 and 7850. And these are the cards. Remember, we looked at the 7900 series first, and those were great, but they were priced at $450 and $550. We looked at the 7700 series, and those were priced at $160. And $109. And what's great about the 7800 is it falls in this $250 and $350 kind of space. And that's kind of like $350 is still a little bit high, but $250 is definitely the kind of like that mainstream gaming card, right? So you got the 7870 and you got the 7850. The 7870 is going to run you the $349 when it comes out. I think it should be available on the 19th of March. So pretty quick. And it competes against it's generally faster than the GTX 570. That it is right on par with performance. But what's interesting is that It kind of gets close in some instances to the GTX 580, depending on the game and the resolution you're running at. And that's significant because the GTX 580 from NVIDIA today still sells for about $120 more than the 7870 does. So, and it does this while being way more power efficient. The 28 nanometer process and the design and the architecture that AMD built with the Northern Islands architecture, I'm sorry, the Southern Islands architecture, is actually really, really, really impressive. When we look at the 7850, it kind of goes head to head price wise with the GTX 560 Ti. And this is like the biggest outright win for AMD since the 7000 series launched. It's way faster than the GTX 560 Ti, and it costs about the same. And it's almost as fast as the GTX 570, and it's about $90 less expensive. So the Pitcairn GPU, which is the code name for the GPU on the 7870 and 7850, are really the GPUs that I think deserve the most attention. Like, if you're a high-end guy and you're paying $500+ for a video card, you already know what you're going to buy. You have. But for the average gamer that wants to play high-end games, but they don't want to spend all their money, I think the 7870 and 7850 are probably the best options out there right now until whenever own kind of mainstream options on the market as well. It's impressive what they've been able to do in performance. It's much more impressive what they've been able to do for efficiency, just in terms of performance per watt. Because I mentioned this 7850 and the 560 Ti, 7850 way outperforms it, and it does so while using like 50 watts less power under load. That's really, really significant. And they, you know, I think when these cards are actually sold, or for sale, they will sell quite a bit of them.
So the 7800 series sounds like the new mid-price GPU of choice.
Yeah, right now they're definitely that, right? If you want to spend $250 on a video card, I would tell somebody to buy a 7850. It's not available till the 19th, but that's what I would tell somebody after the 19th, is that's a good way to go. And there's overclocking headroom on these cards. And the 7850 only requires a single 6-pin power connection as well, which is, you know, just a nice bonus on top of things. So things are progressing in the GPU market in a way that we kind of expected, but I didn't think it was going to be this dramatic in terms of how quickly we've increased and improved on the cost or the performance per watt aspect of GPUs. You know, when we saw the 1200 watt power supplies, we were thinking we're going to have to keep those or continue on past that, even to the 1300 watts and that kind of stuff. We're getting the same graphics power. We're actually getting more gaming power for less wattage, which is good. We want to see that trend continue. So either way, it's pretty impressive. And there's lots of reviews out there. We've got ours at PC Perspective and everybody else. You know, any of your favorite hardware review site will have reviews of the 7870, 7850. They're nice looking parts. They're going to do well.
What's going on with the Asus and the Z77 chipset motherboards?
So this is kind of interesting. So we know Ivy Bridge is coming out soon, and we know that Intel's Z77 chipset is going to be the chipset that launches with that. Well, we've talked about on the podcast several times that there have been kind of some delays with the Ivy Bridge technology or the Ivy Bridge release. And I think what's happened essentially, I don't know this for sure, but what I think has happened is that their motherboard partners have just gotten really aggravated about the delays. It was originally going to launch at CES. And if you're a company that spent R&D time, right, with the whole goal of selling this platform, then to have them delay and delay and delay, it's costing you money. And I think what's going to happen now is we're going to see Z77 motherboards come out before the Ivy Bridge processor actually comes out. Now, I wouldn't recommend buying a Z77 board and then buying a Sandy Bridge processor if you are planning on buying an Ivy Bridge. That obviously doesn't make any sense. But we'll be able to do reviews and testing and benchmarking of the features of Z77. So we went out to see ASUS recently. And what's interesting about this is they showed off pretty much their entire lineup of Z77 boards are going to be available. And they had some pretty interesting ones. The very first one listed on the article, on the second page of the article, is the P8 Z77i Deluxe, which is a mini ITX Ivy Bridge motherboard. So they already have a mini ITX version of this board, of this chipset, for this platform. It has a full-size PCI Express by 16 slot, 2 DIMM slots. It's got 4 USB 3 plus USB 3 headers on the motherboard, DisplayPort, HDMI, DVI output. I mean, it's got a ton of features, and it apparently, according to ASUS, overclocks really well to boot. So I don't. This doesn't seem like the kind of board somebody would buy to overclock, but if you wanted to do that, it's an option. And then they went through some of the other boards. If you go on to the next page, you'll see the Sabertooth and the Maximus. Or wait, you see the Maximus 5 Formula and the Gene. These are kind of like the really high-end boards, but there's a micro ATX version. Both of these boards have a micro PCIe combo card that allows you to plug in a mini SATA SSD and a PCI Express edition, which could be another SSD, or it could be a Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, 3G, GPS, anything like that that has a mini PCIe connection. So you could plug two of these devices into essentially a desktop motherboard. So it's actually interesting on the amount of things you'll be able to create and do with this platform as well. But you know, overall, it's, you can look through all the pictures of the boards if you like that kind of thing and see all the features. The Sabertooth board is one of those ones that now has armor all over. It's supposed to protect it from dust and that kind of thing, using higher end capacitors that are more heat resistant, longer term lifespan, that type of thing. The PCI Express slots are covered in like little plastic. They have like little plastic covers on them so that when you're not using them, they're not going to get dusty and that type of thing, which is actually kind of cool. And I wish they'd maybe put that on all the motherboards, regardless if it had the rest of the armor. But yeah, it's interesting. And then they have the workstation board as well.
TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor manufacturer, shut down their 28 nanometer process mid-February, comes back up in March. Kind of an interesting interesting thing. It's kind of hard to tell why. It's because NVIDIA apparently was having issues with the 28 nanometer process. And then Digitimes today now said that basically not only 28 nanometer, but the 20 nanometer process line is going up because TSMC thinks that demand could go up to as high as 95% of their capacity. So it's interesting. The speculation is that they shut down the line to, quote, ensure no preventable problems would prevent them from meeting the high demand that is coming. But interesting that one of the big non-Intel semiconductor manufacturers just shuts down their line for like a month. But
we'll see how it affects AMD and the NVIDIA GPU side of things, because that's the process and the foundry that both of them are using. So we'll see if there's any hiccups in inventory in the next month or so.
It can be hard to be a fabless semiconductor manufacturer
if there's no fabs.
But it's not hard to do though. Oh my goodness. Let's stop down for a second, take a moment to thank our friends over at Ford who are sponsoring this episode of Twitch.
This episode is indeed brought to you by Ford and featuring Curve Control. Now take a step back. Let's talk about what this is. Curve Control is part of a suite of safety technologies in the 2013 Ford Taurus. It helps drivers maintain control of their vehicle when taking a curve too quickly. Here's how it works. So first, it looks for potential problems by measuring things like how quickly the vehicle is turning versus how quickly the driver is trying to turn it. That seems crucial to me. it measures roll rate, yaw rate, lateral acceleration, wheel speed, and steering angle. All these things are only a few of them do I understand. It's like I'm flying a plane again all of a sudden. It runs calculations 100 times every second to measure all those devices to try to prevent you from having any accidents while you're in these under the curve control settings. When it does find a problem, curve control will rapidly reduce the engine torque, which will then prevent the, I guess would be over or under steering, probably either, I guess, Patrick. It applies four-wheel braking, slows vehicle up to 10 miles per hour in 1 second, and it works on dry or wet pavement. So it's not like going to slam on your brakes and make you come to a halt, because that might be a little more dangerous than anything else. But it will, but it will slow you down to the point where you may not have the issue coming out of the turn. You can maintain control of your vehicle while taking the curve. Curve control helps protect while driving on curves, and it's one of several new driver assist technologies available in the 2013 Ford Focus. You can learn more about curve control at ford.com/cars/Taurus. That's Taurus. And we thank Ford for their support of this week in computer hardware. And I think anybody can get behind companies looking to improve the safety of vehicles. So,
it was funny. I drove a truck without any lock brakes in it. A truck I had sold to a friend of mine, and he lent it to me to pick something up. And I forgot how exciting life can be in a truck when it's rainy if you stand on the brakes a little more heavily than you're used to.
Yes. I have a Dodge Durango that does not have anti-lock brakes, and I found that out accidentally one time. Yeah.
Exciting stuff. And yeah, Ford is doing some amazing stuff in very affordable cars, too. Mm-hmm. I like that. Mm-hmm. Interesting thoughts. While we're talking about fast GPUs, Tech Power Up Extreme Tech are reporting on leaks that came out at CeBIT from some NVIDIA's partners. GTX 6080, approximately 10% faster than the HD 7970, quote, in certain applications. Another, it's slower, should be unveiled in the next week or so. And the part that kind of knocked me back on my heels was the GTX 680 is the GK104. It's the part number. Oddly enough, more of the mid-range enthusiasts offering 1,536 CUDA cores running at 703 megahertz and a, quote, 1,406 megahertz hot clock. 1,536 CUDA cores sounds like a lot. Is that me, or is that just, am I just sort of out of touch with the number of CUDA cores this afternoon?
Well, the GTX 580 has 512 CUDA cores.
Okay, so I am right. That's a lot of CUDA cores.
So you're tripling the number of CUDA cores. Yeah, essentially, if that remember. So here's the thing. I really can't say too much about it, but I mean, based on those rumors that are coming out of there, I mean, that looks like a powerful part. Right. And that is kind of interesting to me is that GK104 is the, quote, mid-range enthusiast offering, which would insinuate that there would be like a GK110 higher end part that would have more CUDA cores than that. I don't know if that's the case or not, but that's a lot. That's a lot of stuff.
That's a lot of avenues.
It's good. I mean, if you're a high end gaming enthusiast, the spring is going to be interesting and exciting. And even if, you know, as we saw the 7700 and 7800 cards from AMD, even if you're not high-end gamer and you're just kind of a mainstream gamer, there's going to be some great options out there for you too. So it's good. It's good. Anytime we can, hopefully what we will see is price compression instead of price expansion, you know, where this card is going to come out at $600 instead of 550 or something like that. So that would obviously not do us any good.
That would be bad. Visual computing still decades from computational apex. And why was I not surprised to find two names? Well, the first of John Carmack and Tim Sweeney, Epic Games, Tim Sweeney, John Carmack, found id Software, a friend of PCPer.com and the creator of Doom. DICE 2012. What are these guys basically talking about? The future of computing hardware, the future of visual computing. What are they seeing? Basically, what it sounds like is it's all going to get super much better.
Well, so it was interesting. I'm sure you've probably heard the mentality that, you know what, consoles are fast enough. There's going to be one more generation of consoles, but chances are we're at the area where graphics is good enough. We need to do other stuff. We need to improve on how we do AI. We need to improve on how we do all these other things that the graphics are good enough. And Tim Sweeney did a talk at DICE that kind of went over why he thought that was just not correct. And he did it with some math, which is always good, right? It kind of gets the point across. The quick summary of it, I highly encourage everybody to go to the PCPer.com and read this article because it's really, really interesting how he lays it out. We've got slides from his presentation and that kind of stuff that we got from a video that was on GameSpot. And it goes over some of the ideas, right? So he's saying that the human eye is equivalent to a 30 megapixel camera. The ideal resolution for where the eye can't tell any pixels anymore from like a 90 degree field of view is 8,000 by 4,000 resolution. So we're relatively close to that, I think, you know, speaking. And then he goes into, you know, how much more triangle processing power would we need for that, which is only like a factor of 50 from where we're at today. That's actually attainable in maybe one or two generations, probably two to three generations. But then he talks about calculus for a little bit. And if you're, you know, if you don't fall asleep during the parts, it's really interesting where he talks about, you know, a first order approximation of lighting in a game is like Doom. If you look at the original Doom, if you look at a second order approximation of lighting in a game, you're looking at something like Unreal, where you're looking at it, where it bounces two times instead of just once. And then if you look at third-order approximations, you're looking at games like Battlefield 3, like the Unreal Samaritan demo, which have these really, really intense lighting models that take a ton of computing power. And the general consensus is that today the Samaritan demo requires 2.5 teraflops of computing performance, whereas the Xbox 360 has about 0.25 teraflops of computing processing. So that alone should tell you that we're definitely more than one generation out of consoles or PC hardware. But then he kind of theorizes, hey, you know, things like lighting, how lighting bounces off shadows and color and skin and smoke and water, we understand all that mathematically. We can approximate that using calculus. And anything that you can approximate, you can get close. You can't get exact, but you can, you know, simulate it to, you know, any number of approximations beyond even three. He says that his estimation for good enough is 5,000 teraflops, or roughly 2,000 times the amount of processing power that today's best GPU hardware can provide. So that's a pretty big number. If we think we need 2,000, a factor of 2,000 more processing power out of our GPUs, and we're talking PCs, and consoles and that type of stuff, we're going to see big iterations in graphics hardware for quite a while. It's not over. We're not at the end of the road, so to speak.
There you have it, people. Game Developers Conference 2012. Not a huge conference for hardware. But one of the big rumors going into this was that Valve would announce a Steam box, a Steam hardware platform at GDC. Yeah. Oh, I'm thinking at this point, that's not likely to show up until E3.
It's not going to happen at GDC, right? It was an interesting concept, though. The rumor that was going around was that Valve was going to maybe make themselves more likely partner with somebody to make a system, to make a PC that would eventually essentially be a Steam box. It'd be a console of sorts for PC gaming that would run Steam. It would have a Steam 10-foot user interface. It would have standardized hardware specifications that maybe were upgradable within certain segments so that game developers could QA against things and have a more stable environment. They had apparently had patents for specific controllers as well. But it didn't happen at GDC unless there's some kind of surprise tomorrow, but I can't imagine the last day that they would do that. But it's an interesting idea to try to, how do we make PC gaming more successful? Maybe try to standardize things, maybe try to make it easier for users to buy into PC gaming, while still allowing some portion of the flexibility that makes PC gaming so attractive to so many people, right? I mean, one of the benefits of PC gaming is that I can buy a GTX 680 when it comes out, right? And I can get better performance out of it. So if something like this existed, then maybe NVIDIA would have to submit their GPU and a certain driver version to Valve. It would go through some QA testing through Valve and Alienware, whoever their partner would be. And, you know, then you know that you could buy that graphics card with that software version and it would run and you would be successful in it. I like that idea. I think it's a good middle ground between the completely locked down platform that is the Xbox 360 or the PlayStation 3 and the completely open world of the PC as it is today. I don't know. Any thoughts on that? I mean, is it something that you would consider?
Well, I mean, I've got a Core i7 box and I'm about to drop a new GPU into it. So part of me is like, why would I do this? On the flip side, you start taking a look at Steam and you're talking about a platform, which is a phrase, a word, a bit of jargon that's completely abused in any corner of the tech industry. But you're looking at a platform with 40 million users on it with radically varying levels of hardware. But I think if anybody has either the cachet or the clouds or the chutzpah to put together PC gaming, basically a box for PC game, essentially, you know, putting PC games in a console, it would be Steam. I'm really curious to see. I would love to see this happen simply because, you know, I'd like to see somebody really put a scare into the PS3 and the Xbox 360 in terms of improving the graphics because, you know, they're nice. I like what stuff looks like on my PC a lot better.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree.
Call me a simple creature.
I agree. I think I'm a huge fan of the whole open ecosystem of things, but there are definitely, when my friends that want to play PC games come to me and they have driver issues, or they have stability issues, or they have configuration issues where they just don't know what settings to set on their machine, and they're not the type of person that wants to go in and edit a bunch of things to make sure they get the best image quality while also making sure they're not getting low performance in the places where it's the most strenuous, and you could get some kind of way that kind of created a profile for that type of stuff as well would be pretty beneficial, while still maintaining the open platform that is Steam, where any developer can release a game on it, and the major developers still release games on it as well, which I think is a big key there. You posted a link here to MNPC Tech, and you said you forgot how fun this was. What are we looking at here? This is this is like case modding stuff, right? It's been a while since I've looked at this.
Well, it's kind of funny. They've got a MNPC Tech. They've got a case modding blog.
Check out my new blog. No, I don't have. Oh, why do you ask?
But basically, if you're thinking to yourself, gosh, I really need to upgrade my case, or I'm thinking about a case mod, it's a really fun site. Partially, mostly because of the hardware they sell. If you don't
have the Transformers head. Store.
Got the Transformers head. They've got some really amazing, like, you know, milled aluminum fan grills and case feet, like knurled case feet, grooved case feet, polished case feet, rubber case feet. Some really interesting tools. For example, possibly my favorite tool in forever. It's a Molex pin tool.
Wow.
That just made me really happy to know that ATX pin removal tool, ATX Molex removal tools. So if you want to start really playing around with stuff, billet case handles, stainless steel hardware for your fan, 200 millimeter and 230 millimeter fan grill, so I can finally put a fan grill over the top of that gigantic fan I bought, or what I call round modders mesh. So it's like honeycomb, which is 79% airflow mesh that you can drop over the side of your case or the front of your case. And some really nice switch plates and switches, like the Vandal Proof switch, which is a 7/8-inch stainless steel button you can pop on the front of a case. I just got really happy looking at the case mod store. The Modders Reference Tool, a measurement tool made exclusively for PC building and modding, identifying cooling fan sizes, computer screw threads, vandal resistant switch, water cool barbs, and hose dampers. So it's basically got all of the stuff you need to like measure fasteners, templates for Lamtron
awesome.
Switches and water cool barbs. And yeah, I just saw, if you're thinking about modifying your case, have some fun looking around this site and hand somebody you trust your credit card before you do, because this could be hell on the impulse purchases if you're not careful. Just saying.
Yeah, indeed.
7-volt fan resistors, so you can slow down fans so they're less noisy.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I miss doing that stuff. We might have to do some stuff. We might have to do some video stuff with that in our new office space when we got some extra room to do projects. We just need extra time to do projects too. Damn.
Just have your sleep removed.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know there was a surgery for that. I'll sign up.
I'll tell you about it later.
Let's take a quick break here before we get into a couple of emails and make sure we thank our second of today's podcast sponsor. That would be Netflix. Everybody who listens to the show knows who Netflix is. If you don't, if you haven't signed up, if you haven't tried the service, you obviously need to do this. Netflix is the company that allows you to stream thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you pretty much wherever you are and pretty much nearly instantly. So you can, of course, watch Netflix movies on your PC or Mac. You can watch on your iPad, the new iPad, your iPhone, a lot of the Android phones out now. If you don't have any of those devices, you don't want to, you can always watch it on your TV through an Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, Nintendo Wii. You can get a Roku box. You can get an Apple TV, even the new Apple TV, I assume. And also check your DVD player, your Blu-ray player, your TV. It might already have Netflix integration already on it. The stuff is everywhere. You can watch movies and TV shows instantly. You can begin watching a movie or show in one place and then finish it in a different one, which is really great if you're moving around from your house to your office to travel and all that kind of stuff. You can watch any number of movies and TV shows as many times as you want. So if you need to repeat things, kids and you're watching shows over and over again, or you just have a favorite movie, you have a collection of favorite movies that's on streaming, you can watch as often as you want. There's never any kind of extra fees for that. You get unlimited streaming with Netflix here. So we want you to try the service out. We really think you're going to like it. It's netflix.com/twit. You go there, you sign up, you get 30 days completely free. Watch as much stuff in that 30 days as you want to make sure that it's a service you're going to like. We think you're going to love it. It's netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use that URL when you sign up. And we thank Netflix for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and the entire Twit network, really. So thank you to Netflix for that.
Woo! We have Mark emailing in about a slow boot. Hey, Ryan and Patrick, I love the show and all your work at PC Per and Techzilla. Thanks, man. After doing a diagnosis by debit card on my PC for system lock. Ouch. It turns out it was the motherboard, so I got the new Asus Sabertooth X58. I have a Micron SSD. Not a super fast one, but a good one. 12 gigs of Corsair 1600 RAM, Core i7-920, and it's overclocked at 3.67 gigahertz. Anyhow, when I boot, it hangs on the BIOS splash screen for at least 16 seconds. And then Windows can take anywhere from 30 to 60 seconds to boot. And yes, I have a quick boot or whatever it's called enabled in the BIOS. If I go into the BIOS and hit exit and save, it goes through the BIOS splash screen in 2 seconds and Windows loads in 10 seconds. Help! This is making me insane. Man, I wonder if it's searching for drives for a RAID.
So there are lots of things that it could be. The thing that gets me is that he says when he goes into the BIOS and then exits, it doesn't do it. So I wonder if there's like if it's doing like a memory check, if there's some kind of memory validation option in the BIOS that you can maybe disable. Because you would think even if you go into the BIOS. No, you know what? I think you might be right. I think it's a storage controller of some kind. Maybe you have a drive hooked up that's going bad and it's having problems reading it and getting its smart data off of it or something like that. Because what would happen is when you enter the BIOS, when you go into the BIOS, you're going to go through all those storage controllers. Hang on a second. Somebody's coming in my door. That's fine. Just leave it there. Thanks.
Sorry, the way you said that, it sounded like, you know, this is going to be beginning of our superhero revenge episode where I have to, like, run.
No. Sorry.
Across San Francisco and rescue you as the door gets kicked in.
Somebody's coming in the door. When you go into enter the BIOS, as you go through the process of entering the BIOS, it will actually load all of the storage controller BIOSes as well. Right. So it will have already gone through that process. When you exit the BIOS, it knows where everything is and it would just immediately go into the boot process. Whereas if you're cold booting it, it would have to go through all that before you do that. So it does sound to me like it's a storage controller. I would go into the BIOS, find a storage controller you're not using and disable it. Right. Disconnect a drive that you're not using and see if that speeds things up as well. That's always possible.
Yeah. It also occasionally, if you do something really strange in the boot order, you can really irritate yourself because it's like for some reason looking for, you know, something on the network or looking for a USB drive, just start shutting things down. And also, by the way, do yourself a favor and see if there's a BIOS update, a firmware update for your motherboard manufacturer, because this may be a known problem. They may have fixed it and you just might not have known or discovered that yet, which can be immensely frustrating.
Indeed. We got an email here from Bernie about wasting some tax money. He says, I just did my tax return and have a bit more coming back than I anticipated. Congratulations. And am trying to decide how to spend it. Figure $500. He's currently running an i5-750 on a Gigabyte P55 board, GeForce GTX 560 Ti. He only really plays Civ 5, Star Wars The Old Republic, and Skyrim, and all play fine on my 22-inch monitor. I'm contemplating getting a new motherboard and CPU to do some future-proofing and cascading my old combo into my home theater PC, but I'm also considering buying an SSD. Here's the catch. I'm a network engineer and managed to score myself a pair of 15K 300-gig SAS drives via trade with a storage engineering buddy. So my main Windows install and my app installs are all living on said 300-gigabyte mirror. Thing is, those SAS drives run hot and loud such that I have to kill my machine to sleep at night lest I face the wrath of my fiance. And an SSD offers a nice, quiet, and fast alternative. So it's been a long... 15K SAS drives are nice. But
no, they're not. They were great right up until SSDs became affordable. And then second they became affordable, they became loud, whining, whinging, evil, heat generating. Don't give me up. Let me take it back. 15K drives. 15K drives are cool. And, you know, 300 gigabytes is probably more than you're going to get out of. For $500, you could pick up like a 256 gigabyte drive. But in terms of like having one anywhere near you sleep, where you sleep, 15K drives are horrendous. They are loud. They are fascinating pieces of engineering, but they are stupid loud and stupid fast and stupid irritating, and they generate a lot of heat. Get the SSD. Get the SSD now.
I would agree with that. And for $500, you can get a really big one too.
Yeah, or get a small, you know, get a manageable, a modestly sized one and pick up a couple of 3 terabyte drives. But I'm glad you had them. They were a healthy performance boost over any drive you had when you got them. But now, my friend, it is time to embrace the SSD. And once you boot the first time with the SSD, you're going to look at the 15K drives and be like, yeah, that was nice. Goodbye.
That's true.
Patrick's got a question about GPU temperatures. Hey, guys, love the show. Been listening since day one. Thanks, man. Yeah. I do Bitcoin mining on my specially built rig with 10-plus fans with a pair of – speaking of boxes you don't want near you when you sleep, 10-plus fans with a pair of Asus 6870s. I've heard that the max temperature to ensure longevity is about 80 degrees Celsius. The thing is, I'm running these cars at 82 to 90 degrees 24/7 with a short breather for crisis every once in a while. So far,
that's a breather.
Yeah. So far, they've lasted 9 months. But in reality, how long should I expect these cards to last? Okay. One thought, and it's kind of a crazy thought, is having them running all the time at maximum speed as long as your cooling doesn't break is probably a lot better than running them at maximum speed and dropping them back down to zero and running them at maximum speed and dropping them back down to zero, because in many cases, it's thermal cycling, as in getting hot and getting cold, getting hot and getting cold, that makes for trouble more than just keeping at a steady temperature. That says, you know, technically, hardware, you know, silicon never breaks except when it does. You know, it's probably going to be like the resistors on the board or the fan on the board. I'd be really terrified of the fan on a bunch of those on the cards going away, more so than I would with the actual, you know, CPU on the board.
I would consider, if depending on how attached he is to these cards and what his budget is, you know, you could get some $30, maybe there'll be as much as $40. It's hard to say, like replacement coolers for the GTX 570s. I know they make those. Zalman has some that might lower those temperatures by a good 15 degrees Celsius. While they're in use. And if you're really concerned about, you know, using those long term and maybe even after you upgrade, keeping that system to do Bitcoin mining or whatever it is you want to do with it, it might be worth investing in a pair of those for your cards, because 90 degrees is not outside safety realm for a GPU, but it is really, really hot, right? And it's not necessarily going to prevent them from dying, but it will, let's just say your cards will be less likely to die at 70 degrees Celsius than at 90 degrees Celsius. I think that seems obvious, but, you know, depending on what you're, if you're willing to spend $30 for each of those cards to upgrade their coolers, you can do that. And it's fairly painless and easy to do. I would imagine you could, those could run for years at those temperatures. Or they could run for a month, but I'm leaning more towards years. It's you know, the death rate of GPUs is probably exaggerated quite a bit by people who aren't overclocking and modding stuff in terms of voltage mods and that kind of deal. So
yeah, people who don't stress their hardware regularly tend to be a little more conservative than those of us who do terrible, terrible things to hardware on a regular basis.
Yes.
We need to get you out of here so you can make your super special secret probation dinner, double secret probation dinner. What's coming up on Peace and Purpose this week?
We have a couple of power supplies coming up. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have any GPUs this week. At least not too many new launches. So that'll be maybe a shift for next week. We won't have a new graphics card. we'll make sure we have a graphics card to talk about next week. Other than that, I've been out for several days, so I'm not even sure what our status is on some of our stories, but I know we've got we're out here visiting NVIDIA. There's going to be cool stuff coming from them very soon, not in the next week. But looks like we'll finally have our answers on the Kepler side of things pretty soon, actually.
Techzilla.com is pretty chill. We just did the Mahi build on some older hardware, which was fun. I'm going to be talking about sort of the next stage once you've gotten the Mahi installed. The Mahi being an open source home server. It also makes me want to start building free NAS and Unreal. So Mahi is like it's essentially, it's not like not necessarily NAS hardware like FreeRAID or UnNAS, UnRAID or FreeNAS, but more of a more general server. It does DNS. It can do DHCP. It can do dynamic DNS. It serves video. You can load additional applications onto it to extend its capabilities. It's an interesting piece of kit. There's a couple tricks to installing it. I talked about that in the install that we just did. And
I'm curious about UnRAID. We're about this close from doing an UnRAID system at our new office. So
UnRAID's really, really interesting, but we need to get you out of the building. So we'll talk about that next week. Twitch, TWICH, Twitch at twit.tv is the email address. We'd love to have your hardware questions. Please fire them in. And we got to get going. So I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.
You can think of a title stuff while I figure out why this guy busted in my door.
Did he leave you food?
He dropped something off, and it might actually be. Oh, look here. Yeah, this is funny. It's an NVIDIA cookie.
You're like, go away.
Yeah, he was like, well, he knocked on the door, cookie. And I was like, surely he'll hear me talking in here, but obviously not.